This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. You know, it's big news when a company brings jobs into any community. A corporation moves to town or it reopens a factory. New positions are created, and that's something to celebrate, particularly because North Carolina has the nation's fourth highest unemployment rate. But how much job creation do we need to really turn things around in this economy? And does it matter if the jobs are low-wage or high-salary positions? For the last part of today's show, we're going to explore the direct relationship between job creation and the economy and just how we're doing as folks who live in North Carolina. Joining me at Triad Stage is Andrew Broad. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Business and Economic Research, which is based at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Andy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with me is Thomas Thiemann. He is Jefferson Pilot Professor at Elon University. Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Tom, let me start with you. The headlines about new jobs. We've got any number of new possibilities in the state bring in anywhere from 60 to sometimes 2,000 jobs. Is a job a job? Does it matter? Should we applaud every job that's brought into the state?
Right about now, yeah. Things are better the job, the higher the pay, the more extra jobs it makes, the better that is. If we want the state to grow ahead, to move forward, you want people that are earning higher wages because that means they have greater skills, and that all makes a better place to live in a lot of different ways. So a job's a job, but some jobs are better than others, that's for sure.
And Andy, if we're talking about real economic growth and improvement, are we just counting the number of jobs, or is there something else we should be looking at?
Well, it certainly depends how you count. Often we just count the number of jobs. If you go by the number of jobs, employment, we're way down. In fact, we fell a lot further than the rest of the country did. But we also count the strength of the economy in other ways. We also count gross state product or gross domestic product by state, which is the dollar flow of value percolating through the economy. That's as good. It's, you know, neither measure is better than the other. But I think it's fair to say that when you ask the average voter, the average person, what they care about is jobs.
So when we talk about these jobs, though, coming into the state, it's interesting that we're still hovering around 9% unemployment, and yet if you look at the figures on Wall Street, business profits are back about where they were. I mean, does this mean that businesses now can live with 8-9% unemployment and do just about what they'd been doing before? Tom, let me start with you.
Well, they can, because they are. I mean, that's obvious in some ways. I think everybody would rather that there was less unemployment and the people that were employed had higher salaries, higher wages. That's just more business to be there. Like you were saying, that the higher GDP, if you will, is better for everybody. High profits lead, or a leading indicator, of what's going to happen in the economy.
Well, explain to me that, and I'll go to Andy for this, but you can follow up if you want. Why is it true? If I'm making a profit and I'm back where I was and these people aren't working, you say, well, everybody would like, why? If I own a business, why do I want to see more people working if I'm making just as much money without them?
Well, I don't know that you are. I mean, what we've seen is we've seen profits recover nicely, but profits aren't where businesses would like them to be if things had continued on the same trend, say, starting from 2007. So profits have recovered, but it's not quite fair yet to say that profits are good. Sometimes you hear when a recession ends that we're going to have this jobless recovery, and often there are a lot of factors that contribute to that, from automation, outsourcing, and so on. But there's a different factor going on in this particular recovery, in this particular depressed economy, which is unlike anyone we've seen since the 1930s. Tremendous overhang of consumer debt. Consumers really aren't buying. There's just a lack of demand. And that is the big reason. When you talk to business owners, why aren't you hiring? The biggest, the most frequent answer is lack of sales.
All right, well, that brings us back to the whole chicken egg. I mean, this is back to 1929. If they're not buying, we can't build. If we can't build, they won't buy, and we won't have the jobs. How do you get out of that mess?
Well, one of the ways is for the government to buy. And tried that in a limited sense.
Well, that's what got us out of the first mess, but it seems to be off the table these days.
Well, it's a political problem. You know, I mean, many economists would say that's what we should be doing. You know, Ben Bernanke was in front of Congress this morning, even, and he's all worried about the impasse over the Bush tax cuts and the balanced budget. And he cited, I think, a CBO study where if we don't figure out the fiscal cliff, that's what we call about falling out of the fiscal cliff, if we don't get this straightened out, it's 4% hit to GDP.
Wait a minute. Explain that. What did you just say?
So if we don't, what Bernanke said, and I think he was quoting a CBO report.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not
Congressional
positive
Budget
that,
Office.
Right.
Yep.
Was that if we don't figure out, if we don't avoid falling off the fiscal cliff, which is the impasse in Congress now between
right.
the budget, both the tax change, we're going to renew the Bush tax
right,
cuts
right. So,
and the balanced budget thing that we were supposed to have this drop
right.
dead.
Right, right.
That the estimates are that there will be 4% drop in GDP in 2013.
Well, what's behind that, Andy? Because there was a time when a little bit of deficit, the idea of balancing the budget was not that important. It's important at some periods like this to get things going. A little deficit spending, not so bad. A little government spending, since the private sector seems to be a little weak. It worked before. Have the economics changed? I understand the politics. But economically, is that still a valid idea?
I'm sorry, is deficit spending
deficit
still
a... spending an idea to help jumpstart the economy, get things moving, and then pull back and let the private market do its will?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the only answer. I mean, what we are in is in a kind of recovery from what has been termed a deleveraging recession. Balance sheets are being improved. People are trying to save more than they spend, and at least a bigger portion of their income. And the thing is that if all households do that, you get what Keynes called the paradox of thrift. It's one thing for my household to be thrifty, but if everyone's household is thrifty, no one's spending. Well, so we need someone in the economy, because economy-wide, spending equals income, at least to a first approximation. So someone has to spend more than income in order to make up for all of the households trying to rebalance their balance sheets. It can't be small businesses. Big businesses aren't willing to do it. State and local governments are constrained from doing it. The only entity left in the economy that can do this is the federal government. But this is precisely when we've decided deficit spending is a bad thing. We're doing this to ourselves. This is an eminently solvable problem, but we've decided that deficit spending is bad because we like it when it's bad for the economy, but we hate it when it's good for the economy.
Right. Well, and the people you tax are the people who are actually working and those who are benefiting, because, as we say, businesses are back. So if you have a stock portfolio, it's starting to show a
little
bit of...
Well, big businesses are back. I mean, big businesses are sitting on piles of cash like they never have before. Small businesses are under a lot of stress. So that's a very broad brush.
But somebody has money. Somebody's making money, right,
somebody.
In this economy.
Right.
And if you used a little bit of that money at the top and spent that money back into the economy, why, things might be going again. I want you to move just a little closer to that.
I think, to agree that the best person, the best entity to do that is probably the federal government.
When we look at these jobs, too, we sometimes talk about increasing business. So if I've got a store and I've laid a few people off and now business is better and I put a few people on, is that the same as creating a new business in my community in terms of the kind of jobs and what it does economically for my community?
I don't understand the question, so I hope
whether or not
takes it.
No, I'm talking about whether or not if I've got a business that's already established and I'm adding people to that business because things are getting better. That's one way of adding jobs. Another way is to bring a whole new business in or grow a business from my community where the money actually started here and stays here. It's not a corporation where the profits go to shareholders. They're actually circulating. Do those jobs, I've described three jobs, a local job from created by local entrepreneurs.
Right.
A national or international chain that brings a subsidiary here and hires people at maybe $14 an hour, but a lot of the profit goes to shareholders, and expanding an existing business. Do any of those jobs matter? Are they all the same?
Well, in a local sense, the more of the money that stays in the locality, the better. That's why, farmers markets are good for the local economy. You buy that tomato, all the money, or largely all the money, stays in the county or in the 50-mile radius or whatever. If you buy a tomato from California, then most of the money goes to California and to the people who truck it. If you buy a tomato from Mexico, then a lot of the money flows out of the country.
Well, an argument along those lines, let's move to another argument. An argument against higher taxes is, if you tax me, then my money leaves this county and it goes to Raleigh and then it, or to go to Washington, D.C. What good is that? But I want to ask you, as an economist, for people at higher income levels, isn't there a certain threshold at which I stop spending and I start investing and my money really doesn't stay in Guilford County? In fact, goes into a hedge fund somewhere, and again, it flies over the border and leaves my county again, except it doesn't get spent here through government programs. It gets invested in speculative ventures in China.
Well, if you're an investor, you go where the returns are. And as you've pointed out, there's still a lot of returns to be made in business. Is the question whether high taxes necessarily destroy job creation? Well, we kind of had an experiment in that, because we've had a decade or so of reduced taxes on the wealthiest individuals. And the expansion that went from 2001 through 2007 was the weakest expansion we had since World War II. It's now been eclipsed by the one we're in, but the signature domestic policy achievement of that expansion was a series of tax cuts that benefit primarily the wealthy. I mean, we could disagree about whether they should have benefited the wealthy, but you can't really disagree that they did primarily benefit the wealthy.
And that they didn't create jobs.
Not only did they not create jobs, not only was employment growth the weakest of any expansion we'd ever seen since World War II, but investment growth was the weakest of any we'd seen since World War II. Now, you got to keep in mind that when economists talk about investment, they talk about the creation of productive assets, not moving money from this account to that instrument. And there was a lot of that, but there wasn't much creation of productive capital, which is kind of important. So we've had this experiment about, I mean, presumably if raising taxes hurts job creation, then lowering it should help. But we've had a pretty good experiment in which lowering it didn't really help it at all.
And then if we take a look at what's happening to people on the ground, poverty rates are growing. So even as unemployment rates, albeit slowly, are falling, we're finding poverty rates growing at an exceptional rate. And the poorest of the poor, nearly 50% of those who are poor, are at double the poverty rate. They are absolutely poor all throughout this expansion. So again, how do we measure the impact of these jobs? Is GDP really the measure, or should we be looking at how people are being helped through this economy and through this recession?
Well, if you look at GDP, you can look at GDP per capita. That's took the GDP and divide it by the number of people there are, and that drifts up slowly. It goes down a little bit, but drifts up slowly. But then if you look at how it's distributed, it's quite different. If you look at the GDP per capita, it's kind of the average,
right,
as most people think of average. But if you look at the median, half above, half below, that has not gone up. In fact, it may have even gone down some. So we can see that twist that you're talking about. I think some of that has to do with the general misunderstanding of what's investment. A lot of the money being made by the very wealthy is investment in financial instruments, not investments in bricks and mortar and new machinery. Investment in, when you buy a share of stock, you're buying a used share of stock.
Right. Doesn't go back to the company.
No,
it goes to the guy you bought it.
So that's just swapping used assets around, if you will. That's nowhere near as good as building a new factory or buying a new machine so your workers are more productive. So we've got this sort of mismatch in the American mind, I think, of investment. Investment sounds like a good thing, and it is, as economists think of investment. But most people think of investment, I'm going to put more money in my 401k, which, you know, helps you down the line. That's not wrong, but doesn't help the guy looking for a job.
One thing I think is worth pointing out is that we've had a real divergence between a number of important indicators for about 30 years. It used to be that wage growth was pretty much a function of productivity growth in the labor force. And that stopped around...
I'm going to stop you just 1 second. So productivity means how much profit I'm making per hour or per unit. So
you mean everyone understands that way?
I'm getting more for my money as an investor, as a plant. I'm getting more out of these workers and out of my plant. Productivity goes up. And as productivity went up, wages went up. So as people are making more, the company's making a higher profit margin, all's good until 1980, 81. Don't know what happened then. But for some reason, those two fell out of sync.
Well, we think we know. And by the way, that's very good. That's very good. And I should have said that.
Thank you.
But no, that's exactly right. And we think we know what started happening in the early 80s. That was about the time when we started seeing important and increasing returns to education. It's certainly true that the fiscal policies at the federal level over the last decade exacerbated an existing problem, but they didn't create the problem. The problem was there, and the problem is structural. Right about when education started mattering a lot more. I mean, after all, it used to be that jobs were about pushing the coal from here to there. Now they're about manipulating networks and symbols and concepts. Even if you're at a middle level, it's really more about that. Most of us are sitting on our butts, basically. And right when that started happening, you started seeing this divergence. And now we're still studying why. I don't know that we have the answer why, but we think we know what happened. We're not entirely sure why it happened. But the move towards a sort of meritocracy, in some sense, an education-based meritocracy, is when that division started happening. And we've had increasingly unequal income distribution since then.
Tom?
And I think part of that's, yeah, he's right. And a reporter with the facts, how's that, you know? But the other piece that goes with that, I think, is that's about the time we start to really globalize. So we used to have a different social contract when we had a more of a closed economy, when we didn't trade so much. So somebody could be fairly uneducated, go to work in a factory. It was often a unionized factory. Sometimes it didn't have to be unionized if the one down the road was. Right. And so we shared that wealth with the unskilled, if you will. And then when our unskilled are competing with the unskilled around the world, again, starting really in the 80s, it's harder to share that.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Very illuminating. Thank you both for being on the program today. Tom Tiemann's a professor at Elon University, professor of economics. Andrew Broad, senior research fellow at the Center for Business and Economic Research at UNCG. Special thanks to singer-songwriter William Howard, who's been playing live for us this hour. William's new single is called All Out War. You can check him out at williamhoward.tv. And thank you to William. He's going to play us out of this segment in a minute. Thanks to the Triad Stage, our engineering staff today, and the audience. And if you'd like to join us at Triad Stage on August 21st, our next visit here, send us an email at rsvp@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow. Once again, William Howard.
One day we can start again. Where's your motivation? Time is blowing.